Green Mars, Cassette 16.
One day at the office, news came in from the Hellespontus. They had discovered a new aquifer, very deep compared to the others, very far away from the basin, and very big. Diana speculated that earlier glacial ages had run west off the Hellespontus range and come to rest out there underground. Some 12 million cubic meters, more than any other aquifer, raising the amount of located water from 80% to 120% of the amount needed to fill the basin to the -1 kilometer contour. It was amazing news, and the whole headquarters group gathered in Maya's office to discuss it and plot it onto the big maps, the areographers already charting pipeline routes over the mountains and debating the relative merits of different kinds of pipeline. The Low Point Sea, called the Pond in the office, already supported a robust biotic community based on the Antarctic krill food chain, and there was a spreading melt zone at its bottom, heated by the Mohole and the accumulating weight of the many tons of ice pressing down from above. Increased air pressure and ever-warming temperatures meant that there would be more and more surface melting as well. Bergs would be slipping and crashing together and breaking up, exposing more surfaces and warming things with friction and sunlight until they reached a kind of pack ice and then brash ice. At that point, newly pumped-in water, properly aimed to reinforce the Coriolis forces, would start a counterclockwise current. On and on they talked about it, getting further and further ahead of the game, until when they went out to celebrate with a big lunch, it was almost a shock to see the Cornish standing over the rocky plain of the empty basin floor. But today they would not be deterred by the present. They all had a lot of vodka with lunch, so much so that they gave themselves the rest of the afternoon off. And so when Maya went back to the apartment, she was in no shape to deal with the sight of Cassay, Jackie, Antar, Art, Dow, Rachel, Emily, Franz, and several of their friends, all there in her living room. They were passing through on a trip to Sabishi, where they planned to meet with some Dorsa Brevia friends and enter Burrows and spend a few months working there. They were perfunctory in their congratulations on the discovery of the new aquifer, all but Art. They weren't really interested. This and the sudden crowding of her apartment made Maya cross, and it didn't help that she was still affected by the vodka, or that Jackie was so effervescent, with her hands all over both proud Antar, the unbeaten knight of the pre-Islamic epic, as he had once explained to her, and Dor Dao, both of whom stretched under her touch without appearing to mind when she was on the other one, or playing with Franz. Maya ignored it. Who knew what perversion the ectogenes were capable of, brought up like a litter of cats as they were? And now they were rovers, gypsies, radicals, revolutionaries, whatever, like Nergal, except not, as he had a profession and a plan, while this crowd, well, she forced herself to suspend judgment. But she had her doubts. She talked to Cassay, who was usually much more serious than the younger ectogenes, a gray-haired, mature man who somewhat resembled John in feature, but not in expression. His stone eye-tooth exposed like a fang as he darkly eyed his daughter's behavior. Unfortunately, this time through, he was full of plans for ridding the world of the Cassay Vallis security compound. Obviously, he felt that the relocation of Korolyov to his namesake valley had been a kind of personal affront, and the damage done to the complex by their raid to rescue Sax hadn't been enough to assuage him. Indeed, it seemed only to have given him a taste for more. A brooding man, Cassay, with a temper, perhaps that had come from John, though really he wasn't much like either John or Hiroko, which Maya found endearing. But his plan to destroy Cassay Vallis was a mistake. Apparently, he and Coyote had worked up a decryption program that had broken all the lock codes for the Casey Valles compound, and now he planned to storm the sentries, shut the occupants of the city into rovers on a locked course for Sheffield, and then blow up all the structures in the valley. It might work or it might not. But either way, it was a declaration of war, a very serious break in the rough strategy that had held ever since Spencer had managed to stop Sax from knocking things out of the sky. The strategy consisted of simply disappearing from the face of Mars. No reprisals, no sabotage, nobody home in whatever sanctuaries they happened to stumble on. Even Anne seemed to be paying at least some attention to this plan. Maya reminded Casey of this while praising his idea highly and encouraging him to use it when the proper time came. "But we won't necessarily be able to break the codes then," Casey complained. "It's a one-time opportunity, and it's not as if they don't know we're out here after what Sax and Peter did to the aerial lens and Deimos. They probably think we're even bigger than we are." "But they don't know. And we want to keep that sense of mystery, that invisibility. Invisible is invincible, as Hiroko says. But remember how much they increased their security presence after Sax went on his rampage? And if they lose Casey Valles, they might bring up a huge replacement force, and that only makes it harder to take over in the end." Stubbornly, Casey shook his head. Jackie interrupted from across the room and said cheerily, "Don't worry, Maya. We know what we're doing." "Something you can be proud of. The question is, do any of the rest of us? Or are you Princess of Mars now?"
"Nadia is the Princess of Mars," Jackie said, and went to the kitchen nook.
Maya scowled at her back and noticed Art watching her curiously. He didn't flinch when she stared at him, and she went to her room to change clothes. Michelle was in there cleaning up, making room for people to sleep on the floor. It was going to be an irritating evening. The next morning, when she got up early to go to the bathroom, feeling hungover, Art was already up. Over the sleeping bodies on the floor, he whispered, "Want to go out and get breakfast?" Maya nodded. When she was dressed, they walked down the stairs and out, through the park and along the Corniche, which was lurid in the horizontal beams of dawn sunlight. They stopped in a café that had just washed down its section of sidewalk. On the dawn-stained white wall of the building, a sentence had been painted with the help of a stencil so that it was neat and small and brilliantly red. "You can never go back."
"My God!" Maya exclaimed.
"What?" She pointed at the graffito.
"Oh, yeah," Art said. "You see that painted all over Sheffield and Burrows these days.
Pithy, eh?"
"Cow-wow!"
They sat in the chill air by a small round table and ate pastries and drank Turkish coffee. The ice on the horizon blinked like diamonds, revealing some movement under the ice.
"What a fantastic sight," Art said.
Maya looked at the bulky Terran closely, pleased at his response. He was an optimist like Michelle, but more canny about it, more natural. With Michelle it was policy, with Art, temperament. She had always considered him to be a spy from the first moment they had rescued him from his too convenient breakdown out in their path. A spy for William Fort, for Praxis, perhaps for the Transitional Authority, perhaps for others as well. But now he had been among them for so long, a close friend of Nergal, of Jackie, of Nadia as well, and they were in fact working with Praxis now, depending on it for supplies and protection and information about Earth. So she was no longer so sure. Not only whether Art was a spy, but what, in this case, a spy was.
"You've got to stop them from making this assault on Casey Valles," she said.
"I don't think they're waiting on my permission."
"You know what I mean. You can talk them out of it."
Art looked surprised. "If I could talk people out of things that well, we'd be free already." You know what I mean.
Well, Art said, I suppose they're afraid they won't be able to break the code again. But Coyote seems pretty confident he has the protocol, and it was Sax helped him work it out.
Tell them that.
For what it's worth, they listen to you more than me.
Right.
We could have a contest. Who does Jackie listen to least? Maya laughed out loud.
Everyone would win.
Art grinned. You should slip your recommendations into Pauline. Get it to imitate Boone's voice. Maya laughed again.
Good idea.
They talked about the Hellas Project, and she described the import of the new discovery west of Hellespontus. Art had been in contact with Fort, and he described the intricacies of the latest world court decision of which Maya hadn't heard. Praxis had brought a suit against Consolidated for arranging to tether their Terran space elevator in Colombia, which was so close to the site in Ecuador that Praxis had planned to use, that both sites would be endangered. The court had decided in favor of Praxis, but had been ignored by Consolidated, who had gone ahead and built a base in their new client country and were already prepared to maneuver their elevator cable down onto it. The other Metanats were happy to see the world court defied, and they were backing Consolidated in every way possible, which was creating trouble for Praxis. Maya said,
But these Metanationals are squabbling all the time, yes?
That's right. The thing to do would be to start a big fight between some of them. Art's eyebrows shot up. A dangerous plan.
For who?
For Earth.
I don't give a damn about Earth,
Maya said, tasting the words on her tongue. Join the crowd, Art said ruefully, and she laughed again.
Happily, Jackie's troop soon left for Sabishi. Maya decided to travel out to the site of the newly discovered aquifer. She took a train counterclockwise around the basin, over Neeston Glacier, and south down the Great Western Slope, past the hill town of Montepulciano, to a tiny station called Janusplatz. From there, she drove a little car along a road that followed a mountain valley through the violent ridges of the Hellespontus. The road was no more than a rough cut in the regolith, secured by a fixative marked by transponders and obstructed in shadowed places by drifts of dirty, hard summer snow. It ran through strange country. From space, the Hellespontus had a certain visual and area-morphological coherence, as the ejecta had been thrown back from the basin in concentric rings. But on the surface, these rough rings were almost impossible to make out, and what was left was random pilings of rock, stone dropped from the sky chaotically. And the fantastic pressures engendered by the impact had resulted in all manner of bizarre metamorphoses, the most common being giant shatter cones, which were conical boulders fractured on every scale by the impact, so that some had faults you could drive into, while others were simply conical rocks on the ground with microscopic flaws that covered every centimeter of their surfaces like old china. Maya drove through this fractured landscape, feeling somewhat spooked by the frequent kami stones, shatter cones that had landed on their points and stood balanced. Others that had had the softer material underneath them eroded away until they became immense dolmens, giant rows of fangs, tall capped lingam columns, such as the one known as Big Man's Hard-On, crazily stacked strata piles, the most prominent of them called dishes in the sink. Great walls of columnar basalt patterned in hexagons, other walls as smooth and gleaming as immense chunks of jasper. The outermost concentric ring of ejecta was the one that most resembled a conventional mountain range, appearing on this afternoon like something out of the Hindu Kush, bare and huge under galloping clouds. The road crossed this range by means of a high pass between two lumpy peaks.
In the windy pass, Maya stopped her car and looked back and saw nothing but ragged mountains, a whole world of them, peaks and ridges all piebald with clouds, shadows, and snow, and here and there the occasional crater ring to give things a truly unearthly look. Ahead, the land dropped to the crater-pock Noachus Planum, and down there was a camp of mining rovers, drawn up in a circle like a wagon train. Maya drove hard down the rough road to this camp, reaching it in the late afternoon. There she was welcomed by a small contingent of old Bedouin friends, plus Nadia, who was visiting to consult on the drilling rig for the newly discovered aquifer. They all were impressed with this one. "It extends past Proctor Crater and probably out to Kaiser," Nadia said, "and it looks like it goes way far south, so far it might be coextensive with the Australis Tholis aquifer. Did you ever establish a northern boundary for that one?" "I think so," Maya said, and started tapping at her wrist pad to find out. They talked about water through an early dinner, only occasionally pausing to exchange other news. After dinner, they sat in Zake and Nazik's rover and relaxed eating sherbet that Zake passed around while staring into the coals of a little brazier fire on which Zake had earlier cooked shish kebab. The talk turned inevitably to the current situation, and Maya said again what she had said to Art, that they should foment trouble between the metanationals back on Earth, if they could. "That means world war," Nadia said sharply. "And if the pattern holds, it would be the worst one yet." She shook her head. "There has to be a better way." "It will not take our meddling for it to start," Zake said. "They're on the spiral down into it now." "Do you think so?" Nadia said. "Well, if it happens, then we'll have our chance for a coup here, I guess." Zake shook his head. "This is their escape hatch. It will take a lot of coercion to make the powerful give up a place like this." "There are different kinds of coercion," Nadia said. "On a planet where the surface is still deadly, we should be able to find some kinds that don't involve shooting people. There should be a whole new technology for waging war. I've talked with Sachs about this, and he agrees." Maya snorted, and Zake grinned. "His new ways resemble the old ones, as far as I can tell. Bringing down that aerial lens, we loved that. As for firing Deimos out of orbit, well, but I can see his point to an extent when the cruise missiles come out. We have to make sure it doesn't come to that." Nadia had the mulish expression she got when her ideas were set in concrete, and Maya regarded her with surprise. Nadia, revolutionary strategist. Maya wouldn't have believed it possible. Well, she no doubt thought of it as protecting her construction projects, or a construction project itself, in a different medium. "You should come talk to the communes in Odessa," Maya suggested to her. "They're followers of Nergal, basically." Nadia agreed and leaned forward with a miniature poker to tap one of the coals back into the center of the brazier. They watched the fire burn, a rare sight on Mars, but Zake liked fires enough to take the trouble. Films of gray ash fluttered over the Martian orange of hot coals. Zake and Nazik talked in low voices, describing the Arab situation on the planet, which was complex as usual. The radicals among them were almost all out in caravans, prospecting for metals and water and aerothermal sites, looking innocuous and never doing a thing to reveal that they weren't part of the Metanat order. But they were out there, waiting, ready to act. Nadia got up to go to bed, and when she had gone, Maya said hesitantly, "Tell me about Chalmers." Zake stared at her, calm and impassive. "What do you want to know?" "I want to know how he was involved with Boone's murder." Zake squinted uncomfortably. "That was a very complicated night in Nicosia," he complained. The talk about it among Arabs is endless. It gets tiresome. So what do they say?
Zayk glanced at Nazik, who said,
The problem is they all say different things. No one knows what really happened.
But you were there. You saw some of it. Tell me first what you saw.
At this, Zayk eyed her closely, then nodded.
Very well. He took a breath, composed himself. Solemnly, as if giving witness, he said,
We were gathered at the Hajar al-Kra Mashab after the speeches you gave. People were angry at Boone because of a rumor that he had stopped a plan to build a mosque on Phobos, and his speech hadn't helped. We never liked that new Martian society he talked about. So we were there grumbling when Frank came by. I must say it was an encouraging sight to see him at that moment. It seemed to us that he was the only one with a chance to counter Boone. So we looked to him, and he encouraged us to... He slighted Boone in subtle ways, made jokes that made us angrier at Boone, while making Frank seem the only bastion against him. I was actually annoyed with Frank for stirring up the young ones even more. Selim el-Hayl and several of his friends from the Ahad wing were there, and they were in a state, not just at Boone, but also at the Fatah wing. You see, the Ahad and the Fatah were split over a variety of issues. Pan-Arab versus nationalist. Relations to West. Attitude to the Sufis. It was a fundamental division in that younger generation of the Brotherhood.
Sunni Shiite? Maya asked.
No. More conservative and liberal, with the liberals thought to be secular, and the conservatives religious, either Sunni or Shiite. And el-Hayl was a leader of the conservative Ahad, and he had been in the caravan Frank had traveled with that year. They had talked often, and Frank had asked him a lot of questions, really bored into him in that way he had, until he felt that he understood you, or understood your party.
Maya nodded, recognizing the description.
So Frank knew him, and that night el-Hayl almost spoke at one point, and decided not to when Frank gave him a look. I saw this. Then Frank left, and el-Hayl left almost immediately after.
Zayk paused to sip coffee and think it over.
That was the last I saw of either of them for the next couple of hours. It began to get ugly well before Boone was killed. Someone was cutting slogans on the windows of the Medina, and the Ahad thought it was the Fatah, and some Ahad attacked a group of Fatah. After that, they were fighting throughout the city and fighting some American construction crews as well. Something happened. There were other fights going on as well. It was as if everyone had suddenly gone crazy.
Maya nodded. I remember that much.
So, well, we heard that Boone had disappeared, and we were down at the Syrian gate checking the lock codes to see if he had gone out that way, and we found someone had gone out and hadn't come back in. So we were on our way out when we heard the news about him. We couldn't believe it. We went down to the Medina, and everyone was gathered there, and they told us it was true. I got into the hospital after about a half hour of moving through the crowd. I saw him. You were there.
I don't remember.
Well, you were, but Frank had already left. So I saw him and went back out and told the others it was true. Even the Ahad were shocked, I'm sure of that. Nasir, Agile, Abdullah.
Yes, Nazik said.
But el-Hayl and Rashid Abu and Bulan Basaiso were not there with us. And we were back at the residence facing Hajar el-Kra Mashab when there was a very hard knocking at the door, and when we opened it, el-Hayl fell into the room. He was already very sick, sweating and trying to vomit, and his skin all flushed and blotchy. His throat had swollen, and he could barely talk. We helped him into the bathroom and saw he was choking on vomit. We called Yusuf in and were trying to get Selim out to the clinic in our caravan when he stopped us. "They have killed me," he said. We asked him what he meant, and he said, "Chalmers."
"He said that?"
Maya demanded. I said, "Who did this?" And he said, "Chalmers." As if from a great distance, Maya heard Nazik say, "But there was more." Zeke nodded. I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Chalmers has killed me. Chalmers and Boone." He was choking it out word by word. He said, "We planned to kill Boone." Nazik and I groaned to hear this, and Selim seized me by the arm. Zeke reached out with both hands and clutched an invisible arm. "He was going to kick us off Mars. He said this in such a way I will never forget it. He truly believed it, that Boone was somehow going to kick us off Mars." He shook his head, still incredulous.
"What happened then?"
Zeke opened his hands. "He had a seizure. He held his throat first, then all his muscles." He clenched his fists again. "He seized up and stopped breathing. We tried to get him breathing, but he never did. I didn't know tracheotomy, artificial respiration, antihistamines." He shrugged. "He died in my arms." There was a long silence as Maya watched Zeke remembering. It had been half a century since that night in Nicosia, and Zeke had been old at the time.
"I'm surprised how well you remember," she said. "My own memory, even of nights like that."
"I remember everything," Zeke said gloomily. "He has the opposite problem to everyone else," Nazik said, watching her husband. "He remembers too much. He doesn't sleep well." Maya considered it.
"What about the other two?"
Zeke's mouth pursed. "I can't say for sure. Nazik and I spent the rest of that night dealing with Selim. There was an argument about what to do with his body, whether to take it out to the caravan and then hide what had happened, or to get the authorities in immediately. Or to go to the authorities with a lone dead assassin," Maya thought, watching Zeke's guarded expression. Perhaps that had been argued as well. He wasn't telling the story in the same way.
"I don't know what really happened to them. I never found out. There were a lot of Ahad and Fatah in town that night, and Yusuf heard what Selim had said. So it could have been their enemies, their friends, themselves. They died later that night, in a room in the Medina. Coagulants."
Zeke shrugged. Another silence. Zeke sighed, refilled his cup. Nazik and Maya refused.
"But you see," Zeke said, "that is just the start. That's what we saw, what we could tell you for sure. After that, phew,"
he made a face. "Arguments, speculation, conspiracy theories of all kind. The usual thing, right? No one is ever simply assassinated anymore. Ever since your Kennedys, it's always a matter of how many stories you can invent to explain the same body of facts. That is the great pleasure of conspiracy theory, not explanation, but narrative. It is like Scheherazade."
"You don't believe in any of them?"
Maya asked, feeling suddenly hopeless.
"No, I have no reason to. The Ahad and Fatah were in conflict, I know that. Frank and Selim were connected somehow. How that affected Nicosia, whether it did,
He blew out a breath. I don't know. And I don't see how one could know. The past, Allah forgive me, the past seems a sort of demon, here to torture my nights. I'm sorry, Maya stood. The brilliant little chamber suddenly seemed cramped and florid. Catching a glimpse of the evening stars in a window, she said, I'm going to go for a walk. Zeke and Nazik nodded, and Nazik helped her to get her helmet on. Don't be too long, she said. The sky was matted with the usual spectacular array of stars, with a band of mauve on the western horizon. The Hellespontus reared to the east, late alpen glow, turning its peaks a dark pink that sawed at the indigo above it, both colors so pure that the transition lines seemed to vibrate. Maya walked slowly toward an outcropping perhaps a kilometer away. There was something growing in the cracks underfoot, lichen or piggyback moss, its greens all black. She stepped on rocks where she could. Plants had it hard enough on Mars without being stepped on as well. All living things. The chill of the twilight seeped into her until she could feel the X of the heating filaments in her pants against her knees as she walked. She stumbled and blinked to clear her vision. The sky was full of blurry stars. Somewhere north in the Aurium chaos, the body of Frank Chalmers lay in a wash of ice and sediments, his walker for a coffin. Killed while saving the rest of them from being swept away. Though he would have scorned such a description with all his heart. An accident of timing, he would insist, nothing more. The result of having more energy than anyone else, energy fueled by his anger at her, at John, at Unoma, and all the powers of Earth, at his wife, at his father, at his mother, and himself, at everything. The angry man, the angriest man who had ever lived, and her lover, and the murderer of her other lover, the great love of her life, John Boone, who might have saved them all, who would have been her partner forever. And she had set them on each other. Now the sky was starry black, with no more than a dark purple band left on the western skyline. Her tears were gone, along with her feelings. Nothing left but the black world and a slash of purple bitterness, like a wound bleeding into the night. Some Things You Must Forget. Shakata Ganai. Back in Odessa, Maya did the only thing she could with what she had learned and forgot it, throwing herself into the work of the Hellas Project, spending long hours at the office poring over reports and assigning crews to the various drilling and construction sites. With the discovery of the Western Aquifer, the dowsing expeditions lost their urgency and more emphasis was placed on tapping and pumping the aquifers already found and constructing the infrastructure of the rim settlements. So drillers followed dowsers and pipeline crews went out after the drillers and tent teams were out all around the piece and up the Rule Canyon above Harmarkis, helping the Sufis deal with a badly fretted canyon wall. New emigrants were arriving at a spaceport built between Dao and Harmarkis and moving into Upper Dao and helping to transform Harmarkis rule and also settling the other new tent towns around the rim. It was a massive exercise in logistics, and in almost every respect, it conformed to Maya's old dream of development for Hellas. But now that it was actually happening, she felt extremely jangly and odd. She was no longer sure what she wanted for Hellas, or for Mars, or herself. Often she felt at the mercy of her mood swings, and in the months after the visit to Zeke and Nazik, though she didn't make this correlation, they were especially violent, an irregular oscillation from elation to despair, with the equinox time in the middle, wrecked by the knowledge that she was either on her way up or down. She was often hard on Michel in these months, often annoyed by his composure, by the way he seemed so at peace with himself, humming along through his life as if his years with Hiroko had answered all his questions. "It's your fault," she told him, pushing to get a reaction. "When I needed you, you were gone. You weren't doing your job." Michel would ignore that, would soothe and soothe until it made her angry. He was not her therapist now, but her lover, and if you couldn't make your lover angry, then what kind of a lover was he? She saw the awful bind that one was put in when one's lover was also one's therapist, how that objective eye and soothing voice could become the distancing device of a professional manner. A man doing his job, it was intolerable to be judged by such an eye, as if he were somehow above it all and didn't have any problems himself, any emotions that he couldn't control. That had to be disproved. And so, forgetting to forget, "I killed them both. I snared them and played them against each other to increase my power. I did it on purpose, and you were no help at all. It was your fault, too." He muttered something, beginning to get worried as he could see what was coming, like one of the frequent storms that blew over the Hellespontus into the basin, and she laughed and slapped him hard in the face, punching him as he retreated, shouting, "Come on, you coward, stand up for yourself," until he ran out onto the balcony and held the door shut with the heel of his foot, staring over the trees of the park and cursing out loud in French while she battered the door. Once she even broke one of the panes and showered glass over his back, and he yanked the door open, still cursing in French, as he shoved by her and out the door, out of the building. But usually he just waited until she collapsed and started to cry, and then he came back in and spoke in English, which marked the return of his composure. And with only a slightly disgusted air, he would return to the intolerable therapy again. "Look," he would say, "we were all under great pressure then, whether we could tell it or not. It was an extremely artificial situation, and dangerous as well. If we had failed in any number of different ways, we all could have died. We had to succeed. Some of us dealt with the pressure better than others. I didn't do so well, and neither did you. But here we are now, and the pressures are still there, some different, some the same. But we're doing better at dealing with them, if you ask me, most of the time." And then he would leave and go out to a cafe on the Corniche and nurse a cassis for an hour or two, drawing sketches of faces in his lectern, mordant caricatures that he erased at the moment of completion. She knew this because some nights she would go out and find him and sit by him in silence with her glass of vodka, apologizing with the set of her shoulders. How to tell him that it helped her to fight now and then, that it started her on the upward curve again? Tell him without causing that sardonic little shrug of his, melancholy and oppressed. Besides, he knew. He knew, and he forgave. "You loved them both," he would say, "but in different ways. And there were things you didn't like about them as well. Besides, whatever you did, you can't take responsibility for their actions. They chose to do what they did, and you were only one factor." It helped her to hear that, and it helped her to fight. It would be all right. She would feel better for a few weeks, or days at least. The past was so shot full of holes anyway, a ragged collection of images. Eventually, she would forget for real, surely. Although the memories that held the firmest seemed to stick because of a glue made of pain and remorse. So it might take a while to forget them, even though they were so corrosive, so painful, so useless. 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 Better to focus on the present. Thinking that one afternoon in the apartment by herself, she stared for a long time at the photo of the young Frank by the sink, thinking that she would take it down and throw it away. A murderer. Focus on the present. But she, too, was a murderer. And also the one who had driven him to murder, if one ever drove anyone to anything. In any case, he was her companion in that, somehow. So after a long time thinking about it, she decided to leave the photo up. Over the months, however, and the long rhythms of the time-slip days and the six-month seasons, the photo became little more than part of the decor, like the rack of tongs and wooden paddles, or the hanging row of copper-bottomed pots and pans, or the little sailing ship salt and pepper shakers. Part of the stage set for this act of the play, as she sometimes thought of it, which, however permanent it seemed, would be struck at some point, would disappear utterly, as all the previous sets had disappeared, while she passed through to the next reincarnation. Or not. So the weeks passed, and then the months, 24 per year. The first of the month would fall on a Monday for so many months in a row that it would seem fixed forever. Then a third of a Martian year would have passed, and a new season finally have made its appearance, and a 27-day month would pass, and suddenly the first would be on a Sunday, and after a while that too would begin to seem the eternal norm for month after month. And this went on and on. The long Martian years made their slow wheel. Out around Hellas, they seemed to have discovered most of the significant aquifers, and the effort shifted entirely to mining and piping. The Swiss had recently developed what they called a walking pipeline, made specifically for the work in Hellas and up on Vastatas Borealis. These contraptions rolled over the landscape, distributing the groundwater evenly over the land so that they could cover the basin floor without creating mountains of ice directly outside the ends of fixed pipelines, as they had tended to before. Maya went out with Diana to look at one of these pipes in action. Seen from a dirigible floating overhead, they looked remarkably like a garden hose lying on the ground, snaking back and forth under the high pressure of the spurting water. Down on the ground it was more impressive, even bizarre. The pipeline was huge, and it rolled majestically over layers of smooth ice already deposited, held a couple of meters over the ice on squat pylons that ended in big pontoon skis. The pipeline moved at several kilometers an hour, pushed by the pressure of the water spewing out of its nozzle, which pointed at various angles set by computer. When the pipeline had skied out to the end of its arc, motors would turn the nozzle, and the pipeline would slow down, stop, and reverse direction. The water shot out of the nozzle in a thick white stream, arcing out and splashing onto the surface in a spray of red dust and white frost steam. Then the water flowed over the ground in great muddy lobate spills, slowing down, pooling, settling flat, then whitening and shifting slowly to ice. This was not pure ice, however. Nutrients and several strains of ice bacteria had been added to the water from big bioreservoirs located back at the beach line, and so the new ice had a milky pink cast and melted quicker than pure ice. Extensive melt ponds, actually shallow lakes many square kilometers in area, were a daily event in the summer and on sunny spring and fall days. The hydrologists also reported big melt pods under the surface, and as worldwide temperatures continued to rise and the ice deposits in the basin got thicker, the bottom layers were apparently melting under the pressure. So great plates of ice over these melt zones would slip down even the slightest of slopes, piling up in great broken heaps over the lowest points on the basin floor, in areas that were fantastic wastelands of pressure ridges, seracs, melt pools that froze every night, and blocks of ice like fallen skyscrapers. These great unstable ice piles shifted and broke as they melted in the day's heat, with explosive booms like thunder heard in Odessa and every other rim town. Then the piles froze again every night, booming and cracking, until many places on the basin floor were an inconceivably shattered chaos.
This ends side one of cassette 16. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.